Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Welcome to another episode of ID the Future. This is Logan Gage for the CSC, the Center for Science and Culture, out in Washington, D.C. And once again, we have Dr. Michael Egnor, who is gracious enough to join us for another round of questions. And hello and welcome.
Hi, Logan. How are you?
Doing well, doing well. Just wanted to ask you a little bit today about your own research. Now, we know that you're a neurosurgeon and a professor of neurosurgery. Is the title? I'm vice chairman of your department, I believe.
Yes.
All right. I know that what you've been researching is basically how the brain, kind of the method by which the brain protects itself from pulsatility of the arterial blood flow of the heart. Now, what in the world does that mean, and why does the brain need protection?
Well, the brain is really in a very precarious spot, in a sense that it needs a very generous and regular supply of blood and oxygen and nutrients. And it is a very delicate organ. The capillaries of the brain, as capillaries in other parts of the body, are only a single cell thick in their walls, so they're extremely delicate. And of course, the brain tissue itself is delicate. And the brain lives in a rigid box inside the skull. And it's perfused by the heart, which is a very strong pulse pump. The heart isn't a smooth pump that just gives a nice, smooth, gentle flow of blood. The blood that comes out of the heart is like a water hammer. It's a very strong pulse. And it's very well known that the pressure of the blood flow coming into the brain, if you look at one of the arteries as they enter the brain, is very high. In the normal person, it's typically about 120 millimeters of mercury over 80 millimeters of mercury, the normal systolic and diastolic blood pressure. But just a few centimeters distal in the vascular tree, when you get to the capillaries, the blood flow is nearly smooth and very low pressure. So there has been a question that's been open for probably a century, is that how does the brain and other organs in the body, but particularly the brain, smooth out this blood flow so as not to damage itself?
Hmm.
And over the years, I've seen in the treatment of patients who have brain disorders and severe head injury and so on, evidence that I think that some people's brains under some pathological conditions lose some of the ability to protect themselves from this cardiac pulsatility of the heart, and it can damage the brain.
Wow, and what does that lead to? That real brain damage? I mean,
it leads to death if it really breaks down. So it's a very serious matter. And so there are a number of different theories as to how this protection of the brain happens. And
right.
the effect of protecting the brain is called the Windkessel mechanism. It's a German term meaning air chamber. And the notion has been that there's some kind of buffering that goes on. But exactly how the buffering happens, it hasn't been clear. So
Right. Yeah, go ahead.
So I took up this question actually before I was an advocate for intelligent design back, say, probably about eight years ago. And I looked through physiology books, biology books, neurosurgery books, and of course, the literature on this field. And I didn't find what I felt were satisfactory explanations for how the brain protected itself. So I began looking in engineering books. And the question I asked was, and I asked this again before I had any involvement in intelligent design, the question I asked is, well, if I were an engineer, how would I construct the cranium and the brain in such a way as to protect it? And I came across some work that was done by an engineer named Fram back in the early 20th century, who developed a system for protecting vibrating machines. There are situations where a machine is run by an engine, where the frequency at which the engine drives the machine is close to sort of the natural vibrating frequency of the machine, and the vibrations in the machine can become so severe that they damage the machine. So Fram built something called a pulsation absorber, and that was a little device attached to the machine that kind of counteracted the vibrations coming into it and protected the machine. And in reading about that engineered approach, I realized that the way the cranium worked, or I hypothesized, was rather similar, and in fact, when you look carefully at the dynamics, it is rather similar. So we got a research project going here at Stony Brook. We are still very actively involved in that, where we measure the pulsations coming into the brain, the pulsations in the brain itself, and we look at these pulsations using something called spectral analysis, which is a mathematical way of looking at them. And we see very clear evidence, we think, in this data, that that's how the brain is protecting itself. It's using a pulsation absorber mechanism. And I had to go to engineering books to find that out. Hmm. It wasn't in the biology text. And I realized, as I was seeing this, that you can gain a lot of ground in research by inferring design, by saying, this thing, if this was designed, how would it have been done?
Right, but that's not often what we hear in this whole debate over Darwinian evolution and intelligent design. We just hear that intelligent design is a science stopper in the sense of, well, you know, if we admit that an intelligence is the best explanation, that's the best, most likely source of some of the features that we see or the information in DNA, then there really isn't anything left for a good scientist or researcher to do because we'll just say, well, big guy up in the sky did it all and there's nothing left for us to figure out. What do you have to say to that sort of critique?
Well, for me, the inference to design was a science starter. That is that I think that's when we really began to make progress, when we inferred design. Second of all, it's kind of ludicrous to claim that if you see in a natural object evidence that it may have been designed, that would stop your looking into the object. I think just the opposite. If you saw evidence of it being designed, number one, it's absolutely fascinating. And it would make you look at the object in a completely different way. It would make you look at it as an engineered object. And what you would want to do then is to carry out reverse engineering to kind of decode how this thing was put together. So the inference to design is a tremendous benefit to science. And in fact, scientists use it all the time. I challenge any scientist working in molecular biology or molecular genetics in medicine to carry out his or her work without using any concepts of why is this here, what is this intended to do, how does this thing work, without using any concepts of the intention for that molecule or that enzyme. We use it all the time. We just don't admit it.
So to those who say, well, yeah, but you came up with, you know, your hypothesis, you started looking at these engineering journals before you were an ID advocate, so that therefore it had nothing to do with, you know, you can't say, well, ID helped me or was a good, you know, framework. I mean, are you saying in reply, in essence, yeah, but now I have a grounding for what I was doing all along? I mean, is that...
Right. Every scientist who works in this field implicitly uses design. Every single scientist uses the design inference. Scientists who try to study the mechanisms inside cells or the mechanisms by which physiology work, who started out with the premise that it was all just chance, that there was no design involved, wouldn't get anywhere. You have to look at the system as if it were designed. Even Richard Dawkins admits that biology is the study of things that look designed. So you have to infer design. My step was that, I think, that I inferred design, and then I was honest about it and said, yeah, I did infer design. I say it explicitly, and I'm willing to say it publicly.
Right. Well, I'll tell you what, it puts a whole new perspective on our last podcast where we asked you about Dr. Stephen Novella, a materialist who basically said there was nothing left unresolved in neuroscience, that we have all these things figured out, but... We're very delighted to hear about your research, and please keep us updated as there are new developments. We'd love to talk to you again.
Great. Thank you, Logan.
And thanks for joining us for another episode of ID the Future. This is Logan Gage for the CSC. Take care.
Music on ID the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com and check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Bennett. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.